Tonight we're going to do a study of Psalms 14, some of which is borrowed to go into this reading in Romans that Ken just did. So, Psalms 14 only has seven verses, so for you guys out there with your mind on other things, I know, I'm tempted. Yeah. Our first song, yeah, you don't have to worry about who's going to win the Super Bowl. The Lord has made his saints victorious. I'm sure you can find passages for the other way, too, like Jesus ran in the triumph on a colt or something. Okay, for this evening, though, Psalms 14, we're going to look at God's reactions to man's corruption. And this is pretty much what Psalms 14 is about, which is kind of a wake-up call for humanity, as you know, they're going to put it. To help understand the psalm, reference needs to be made to Romans 3, which we just did. This is like the first 12 verses, but actually the whole first, probably the first three chapters of Romans, you know, deals with it. Romans 1 has to do with an indictment against the Gentiles. Romans 2 has an indictment against the Jews. And then as Ken just read, and I think it's verse 9, just as we've just charged, everybody, Jew and Greek, are all under sin. Or by the time you get to Romans 3:23, you know, we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So where Paul cites verse 1 and contends by it that all mankind is under the taint of sin. And this is for man to start, you know, rethinking things, you know, as to where their life is going and how they stand with their God. In the first section, the psalmist sees the prevailing wickedness of the world in general. As we get into this, this is a brief outline of it. When mankind is critically viewed, the impression is that those who dwell upon the earth are fools. Denying the existence of God, resulting in moral degeneration. The psalmist sees also a similar depravity in Israel at the time, verse 3, and knows full well that God will not tolerate such iniquity. And let's see, thus he prays that Israel in particular may be restored to its ideal state. And that's something to keep in mind too. What the writer may have seen and heard about the neighboring nations could have instructed him about moral depravity, you know, as he outlines it here. But the sad oppression of good men under Saul's rule probably demonstrated similar corruption even among God's people. There's a lot I don't want to get into because then I'd be, you know, walking all over my sermon for next Sunday morning because Peter's going to be dealing with this too. So they overlap, but it's a way of letting us know that, well, quite frankly, I'll probably say it again anyway, but there's too many people that think they have no sin at all, that they're just right with God, they don't have to do anything, they don't have to go to church because everything's fine, and that God is, as one preacher used to put it, a peppermint-breathed old grandfather who just pats you on the head and says, that's fine, you can do what you want to. Okay. And what we're looking at, you know, some of the Psalms here and in our studies on Sunday morning, you know, the Bible is screaming, no, that's not right. So, getting into it, God's reaction to corruption. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have committed abominable deeds. There is no one who does good. The writer begins with a working definition of a fool. Nabal, and he describes a largely practical atheism, rather than a theoretical one. I mean, a lot of people sit in an armchair and go, oh, I don't think there's a God. But he's not looking at that. It could incorporate that, but he's looking at a practical atheism. That is, someone who goes out and behaves as if there's no God. And that's pretty much the world. He begins by saying that the fool says this from the heart. I mean, sincerely believes it. Okay? He's not kidding around, very serious about it. The reason being, because he can't afford to have God judging his actions. You know, he's got a world of appetites and pursuits, and he doesn't want anything in the way, so he has to look at, you know, at the way life is, that there's no God in it, because that would just get in the way. He has completely tried to scrub the Almighty from his conscience. Thus, he has always said, they call this the gnomic aorist. Gnomic means it's almost axiomatic. That is, it's just like a rule for them. And this is what they say. They've always said it, that there is no God. When men deny God's existence or live as though he did not exist, then wickedness prevails. Okay, and men become corrupt morally. You know, they can't help it. It's like a mob instinct. You know, the more people, the less the IQ. Okay? Or as even one of the French poets put it, even if there was no God, we'd have to come up with one just to make man behave himself. Okay, they are infected by a mass defection from God. They begin committing abominable deeds, to be defined further. As an example, Wednesdays, in our study in Judges, as we're going through Judges, isn't it getting worse and worse? Okay, as they move away from God, till finally they begin to just make themselves sick with the things that are going on. It cost Israel one tribe in their abominations. It might be said that many even who profess to believe in God are tainted in such a way that their non-obedience, that in their non-obedience, they believe they have no sin. Even among Christians, perhaps among us, there are people, you come to services, you hear the lesson or sleep through it or whatever, then who knows what you do Monday or Tuesday. And maybe you'll do the lesson just before Wednesday night. Is Christianity become, is it a practical application for life? Or is it a bookshelf philosophy? We come to church, we look pious, and then we go home, and then, business is business. The way the world does it. Paul's conclusion, Romans 3, we looked at that, is that we all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. I mean, that's the way they look at it in the Old Testament and in the New. So where does that leave us? It leaves us, hopefully, looking for help from God. And this is what the purpose of these Psalms and a lot of the writings of the New Testament for. Notice, the Lord has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men to see if there's any who understand, who seek after God. Viewed from the divine perspective, it states that God looked down to inspect man. This is the implication of the terms. The verb actually says bent over to look. All the sons of men are made to pass in a review before him. Even as you're going through the Old Testament, how many good people, as you classify, would you find? Even though those that are the kind of stellar ones, Moses and others, they still have their faults. They have their flaws. They have their sins. His purpose is to discern if there are any who discern him, any who are men of insight, who understand, who actually seek after God. I mean, this is something that you have to ask yourself, are you actually looking for God? Are you seeking him? How hard do you work to understand what he's trying to tell you? How hard do you work to try to adapt yourself to what his wills and wishes are? In Hebrews 11:6, we read this, he that comes to God must believe that he is, but more. He's also a rewarder, if you're looking for anything from God, he's a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. You've got to stop and think when Paul says, that we have to strive after our faith as if we're an Olympic athlete. What does that mean? He's trying to tell us how much effort we have to put in. He himself shows us how much he went through, how much he did, how much he struggled and pushed to be acceptable to God. They have all turned aside. Together they've become corrupt. There's no one who does good, not even one. Okay, all here is emphatic. Okay? The Almighty Judge of mankind finds all infected with the same virus. That's all of us. Looking kind of bleak, isn't it? Okay, the theory and practice lie close together is indicated by the fact that the inevitable issues of ungodly theory result in ungodly living. If you don't think there's a God, that's the way you're going to live. biggest objection we have to evolution is that if it keeps telling people that they are animals, they're going to behave that way. Okay? And if you don't believe it, go look at Nazi Germany. Hitler had read Darwin's Origin of the Species. All have gone astray. They have altogether become spoiled. Spoiled. From a verb whose root describes the souring of milk. Have you ever grabbed a bad milk carton? It comes out in chunks and it smells terrible. Okay, that's the way God pictures most of mankind. Apart from divine grace, and this is really what we're getting to here, there's some hope. Okay? Man left to himself has none. But if he starts to look for the divine grace, then there is a ray of sunshine. This is the way mankind looks to the Lord on high without his grace. The last statement is more like a summary. There is no one who does good, not even one. On his own, left to himself, thinking he's good, thinking he can do it all by himself, he falls utterly sad in the light of what God intended him to be. Do all the workers of wickedness not know, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord? The sense of this verse is not immediately connected with the previous, because he's looked at all mankind. Now he's kind of focusing in on perhaps the problem of Israel itself. He says, the workers of the wickedness are those who devour or eat up my people. Now that could be, you know, many of the nations around Israel at this period of time, but it could be the ungodly element in the population of Israel is what you see most of the problem in the Old Testament. You've got, you know, in Isaiah 3:12, Amos 2:6, the problem of those that are in charge, the rulers, they're feeding off their people. Instead of being there to help them, they're abusing him. They're making their living off of them. Okay, they're stealing from them. They're lying to them. They're being unjust in the courts. They prey upon the meek and the lowly. They take cruel advantage of their defenseless position. Psalmist talks about my people. Could be a reference to the psalmist, but whether it's through the psalmist or just God himself, ultimately it's God. It's his people that he's talking about. This is what's really upset God. The ones that are trying to do the right thing, the sinful world, the sinful ones of Israel, are taking advantage of them. But it's God who's the father of the widow and the orphan. The specific sin the fools are charged with here, they devour God's people in order to feed themselves. From the literal meaning of the Hebrew, eaters of my people, they eat bread. Or they just take advantage of them. You know, where they get their bread from, it's because they consume, you know, God's loved ones. Quite obviously, such persons would not be men who are regularly given to prayer, and so they're not the ones that usually call upon the Lord. This is an indictment itself. If one really, you know, was trying to pursue a relationship with God, his prayers would be daily. Yeah, they'd be more than daily. Jews made it a practice at least 3 times a day, you know, as Daniel did, to go to God. 5. There they are in the great dread, for God is with the righteous generation. There is intentionally vague. You know, what are we talking about there? You know, where is that? It's intended to refer to that situation of that time when the Almighty, the Just One, who cannot tolerate iniquity forever, okay, he begins to vent his wrath upon those who oppress his people. When's that going to happen? Anytime. That's why it's left vague. When he took these fools in hand, they were always in great dread, terrified, literally trembled with trembling. The way the Hebrew puts it. They may think they're getting an advantage on their fellow man, but by the time that God gets through with them, okay, they're going to realize that they really made the ultimate transgression. They had failed to see that the meek and lowly have put their trust in the Lord are the objects of his special care, that he is in the midst of his righteous generation. And that's what it's called, the righteous generation. This generation is a special class of people in each time. Since the whole verse is cast in the past tense, it obviously refers to all those instances when God has stepped forward to take care of those that are his. Cases like where Ahab and Jezebel, who preyed upon the defenseless Naboth, okay, God turned the thing around. 6, you would put to shame the counsel of the afflicted, but the Lord is his refuge. The psalmist now states the fate of all who thus oppress the poor. You got to kind of look at this one different than what it appears to look like. When it's talking about the counsel of the afflicted, their plans are counsel against the poor, is what's looked at. Kind of a little iffy translation, but you can see a lot of these things, psalms as poetry, kind of rhyme each other. So you can get it from the second part of this, the parallel, the Lord is his refuge. That is, the poor always have the refuge of the Lord, so he's against those that counsel against the weak or the afflicted. Oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion, and the Lord restores his captive people. Jacob will rejoice, Israel will rejoice. In view of all the unhappy conditions and circumstances of God's people, the writer quite naturally turns to prayer. This is the way he ends this. We're in the last verse. Okay, we're coming down the stretch. Okay. I went a little over this morning. We'll go a little under tonight, all right? Okay, so the writer turns to prayer that God may heal the grievous hurt of his people. From this, his petition is that salvation or deliverance will come out of Zion. And Zion nowadays is another name for the church, or it's the sanctuary of God or whatever. A thorough restoration alone will help overall when the people will completely, when the Lord will completely restore his people. Okay. Now, say a little bit about that. He will, of course, in due time, with the coming of the spiritual kingdom, like for the Old Testament, the kingdom of the church coming, a spiritual kingdom, but also, the second coming when Jesus comes. We can all look forward to that, old and new. But a spiritual revival in mass at any time is what you need. Okay. To put it, a no halfway measure will do. Okay. It's got to be complete, or it's not going to take effect. Okay. Give you some examples. The Ecclesiastes, we may move into that book pretty soon. There's one verse in it. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. When something gets started and it's been in an effect long enough, you can't fix it. You can't just do cut and paste. You can't put the old bubble gum and baling wire on it. You can't do like they do in the Marines, just paint it green and it fixes everything. It takes a whole new revival. Okay? They found this out. They couldn't reform the Catholic Church to embed it. Okay? What they had to do is completely take, clean off the table and start over again, go back to New Testament Christianity and build from scratch. It's the only way it works. Anytime you're trying to fix a nation, you're going to have to clean away everything, all the politics, whatever, and you're going to have to start all over again. I mean, that's the only way we found it works down through history. That's also true of yourself, personally. A little here, a little there, to keep the worldliness, but to put a little patch of Christianity here and a little patch there is not going to fix it. Okay? You're going to have to sweep away and do a total revival of yourself. You're going to have to look at what God wants you to be, start from scratch, and rebuild. Okay? And this is the way it's viewed at. This is why it's a repentance, a change of mind completely, of getting rid of the old life and starting a new one. That's the only way it works. It's the only way it makes sense. It's the only way that you really have God in your life. As long as you keep thinking, well, I'm good, I've got no sins, you know, everything's fine, you know, God's a doubting old grandfather. Man, give me a break, folks. Even Santa Claus keeps a list of those that are naughty and nice. So don't fool yourself. Okay? Yeah, if you're serious about being right with God, you're going to have to do it His way. You know, start over and make yourself right in a new spirit, you know, within you, that of God's. If there's anything we can do to help, the invitation is extended. Won't you come as we stand to sing?